Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
William Bulfin's delightful book, Rambles in Erin, is an account of the author's travels on bicycle throughout Ireland. One of those trips took place on Sunday the 12th of September 1904, when he and a friend headed south towards Wicklow. Before reaching Dalkey, Bulfin's companion mentioned that there were two men living in a tower down somewhere to the left who were creating a sensation in the neighbourhood. He suggested paying them a visit. Soon they found themselves climbing a steep ladder which led to the door of the tower. "We entered and found some men of Ireland in possession, with whom we tarried until far on in the morning. One of them had lately returned from a canoeing tour of hundreds of miles through the rivers and canals of Ireland. Another was reading for a Trinity College degree and assiduously wooing the muses. And another was a singer of songs which spring from the deepest currents of life. The singer was James Joyce, who stayed with his friend Oliver St. John Gogarty in the Martello Tower in Sandy Cove for 6 days in September 1904. Joyce set the opening of Ulysses on the roof of the tower some months earlier on June the 16th because, as everyone surely knows, he wanted to immortalise the day when he first went walking out with Nora Barnacle, a beautiful girl from Galway. The week before, on June the 8th, Joyce took part in a musical soiree, as reported by the diarist Joseph Holloway. Mr. J. Joyce, a strangely aloof, silent youth with weird, penetrating eyes, which he frequently shaded with his hand and with a half-bashful, faraway expression on his face, sang some dainty old-world ballads most artistically and pleasingly. Later he sat in a corner and gazed at us all in turn, in an uncomfortable way from under his brows, and said little or nothing all the evening. He's a strange boy. I cannot forget him. Later that summer, Nora Barnacle herself heard James in a concert in the ancient concert rooms, Great Brunswick Street, now Pierce Street. One of the songs he sang was Yeats's poem Sally Gardens, set to a traditional air. We cannot be sure if the air he used was the one popular today, or that of Far Beyond the Mountains, to which Yeats's poem had also been set. John McCormack sang in that concert, the only occasion when Joyce and McCormack shared the concert platform. There is a myth that Joyce came second to McCormack in the Fech Ceoil. The truth is that, while they both competed in the Fech, they did so in different years. McCormack won first prize in the tenor section in 1903, and was awarded a scholarship to study in Italy. Hoping to pursue a similar career, Joyce competed the following year. He sang the prescribed song, A Long Farewell, a translation of Slán le Mhoi, written by the 18th century hedge schoolmaster Andreas McGrath. Joyce's performance drew favourable comment. The Daily Independent wrote, "Mr. Joyce showed himself possessed of the finest quality voice of any of those competing." The critic, James Cousin, stated, "At the Fech, I heard a young man with light pompadour hair and hardish grey eyes render a long farewell seraphically." Joyce later parodied the song in Fingon's Wake. "My long farewell I send to you, fair dream of sport and game and always something new. Gone is Hon, my grief, my ruin, our Joss el Joven, our Krishnamurti." For his performance at the Fech, the judge intended to award him first prize, but because Joyce was unable to sight read, throwing the sheet music in the air and walking off, he received only third prize. Another myth has it that Joyce threw the bronze medal into the Liffey. The truth is that, since he couldn't pawn it, he brought it home and tossed it in disgust into his aunt's lap, saying, "You can have it, Aunt Josephine, I have no use for it." It was acquired at auction in London 100 years later for more than £14,000 by one Michael Flatley. When James Joyce died in Zurich in January 1941, Nora placed a wreath in the shape of a harp on her husband's grave in Fluntern Cemetery. This was more than the sentimental gesture of an Irish exile. She remarked, "I made this shape for my Jim, who loved music so much." There was a tender irony here, in light of her sometime remark, "Jim should have stuck to the singing instead of bothering with writing." Over the years, Nora obviously changed her opinion regarding her husband's literary merit. She boasted, "Ah, there's only one man he's got to get the better of now, and that's that fella Shakespeare."
dead days beyond recall, when on the world the mist began to fall, out of the dreams that rose in a happy throng, below to our hearts love sang an old sweet song.
If you ever find yourself driving south towards Arizona on Route 163, there's a particular point on the road where you'll wonder, have I been here before? There's something strangely familiar about how the black tarmac stretches ahead in an unwavering straight line until it eventually disappears into the horizon. The gigantic sandstone formations in the distance, their height exaggerated by the flatness of the desert scrubland, also seem familiar. Suddenly, you realise you have seen all this before, but on screen. For you're now driving through a part of the American West that has been colonised by Hollywood. Just coming up on the right is the sign that marks the spot where Forrest Gump, after running for more than 3 years, decides that his running days are over. A few miles away is the place where Thelma and Louise drove their car over the edge of a canyon and into movie legend. And in about 20 minutes, you'll be in Monument Valley, the backdrop of John Ford's classic westerns, such as Stagecoach and The Searchers. Monument Valley is in what John Wayne would have called, while adjusting his holster, Indian territory. It belongs to the Navajo Nation, and is now the jewel in the crown of the Navajo Reservation that covers parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. Our hotel was called The View. The disarming simplicity of its name does nothing to prepare you for the jaw-dropping panorama visible from the rooms. They all face east and look towards the huge sandstone needles and flat-topped giant rocks that you recognise from so many films. These rise abruptly to more than 1,000 feet out of a rust-red, dusty lunar landscape. There are no other hotels, few houses, and hardly any people. You know it's real because it's there in front of you, but the sceptic in you wonders if the whole area hasn't been created by a Hollywood set designer. You almost expect it to have been packed away by the time you wake up the following morning. But at 5:30 the next morning, it was all still there as we made our way to the rendezvous point for what was advertised as our Wild West Dawn Ride. Given this name, plus the eye-watering price of the tickets, I was prepared for concessions to the Hollywood image of the Native American in the interests of tourism. Again, I couldn't have been more wrong. Our Navajo guide didn't introduce himself as Running Deer or Soaring Eagle, as I'd feared he might, but simply as Dave. And rather than being kitted out in tribal dress, he wore faded jeans and a leather jacket. He helped us mount, and as the sun rose, he led us in the early morning mist from the stables and onto the trail. He stopped occasionally to point out a rock feature or to explain a little about Navajo life. People were poor, he said. Many homes had no electricity or water. Life was tough. His manner was diffident, and he seemed light years removed from the Hollywood representation of the Native American as either inscrutable sage or fearsome warrior. He asked few questions and had no well-rehearsed anecdotes. The closest he came to showmanship was when he pointed to a ridge in the distance. Silhouetted against the low sun, a rider was waving his hat as his horse reared up on its hind legs. While it's possible that this performance is reenacted every morning at the same time for the benefit of tourists, I'd prefer to believe that the presence of the lone horseman that morning was a happy accident. Call me gullible. I don't care. The next day, we drove on to Tuba City, just 100 miles further south, but 1,000,000 miles further from Hollywood. Here, the poverty of the Navajo is more immediately obvious. Away from the main street, The modest houses are either in a poor state of repair or derelict. Trailer parks abound, but many of the trailer homes are boarded up. A sign announces that a bus service has been cancelled because of antisocial behaviour. Men, some of them quite young, beg for money in front of McDonald's. Before visiting this area, I'd always imagined the Navajo Reservation as a place maybe three or four times the size of the Phoenix Park. In fact, it covers 27,000 square miles. That's roughly the same size as the Republic of Ireland. In that 27,000 square miles, there are only 13 grocery shops. There's 50% unemployment, and the average income is about one quarter the US average. Today, the rate of COVID-19 infection is higher than in any other part of the US, including New York City. The administrators of the COVID-19 Relief Fund for the Navajo Nation recently noticed something odd about the donations to this fund. A surprisingly high number were coming from a small, remote country, Ireland. Much has been written about the connections between Ireland and the first Americans. The heartbreaking gift during the Great Famine of $170 from the Choctaw people. De Valera being made an honorary chief of the Chippewa tribe on a fundraising mission in 1919 because he was a representative of one oppressed nation visiting another. In accounts of the history of the Navajo people, I find it curious how certain concepts familiar to the Irish keep recurring. Nationhood, identity through language, dispossession. And in the generosity of all those who contributed to the Navajo Fund, I sense a sympathy for Leopold Bloom's definition of a nation. A nation is the same people living in the same place, or also living in different places.
The first time I saw the house, I was about 9 years old, and my da and I were on our way to visit my ma in Nace Hospital. It had become part of our twice weekly ritual, which involved a long walk from our home in Rosebery to the bus stop at Charlie Ryan's on Main Street. Then another trek from the bus stop outside Hanrahan's Cafe in Nace, across the Fair Green to the hospital. That particular Sunday, I happened to be sitting on a left-hand window seat, gazing into the distance, when I caught sight of the house down a long avenue of trees. It was just a fleeting glimpse, but enough to grab my attention. There was a turret, and turrets meant only one thing: fairy castles. I asked Dad what it was, but by then we'd passed on by, and he had no idea what I was talking about. The journey home was spent glued to the right-hand window to no avail. Each subsequent bus journey was spent in this manner. I scanned every field between Newbridge and Nace until my vigilance bore fruit. I discovered that I had to count three fields past the Red House Hotel to catch sight of the object of my obsession. Car trips were of no use, as they didn't have the height necessary to see beyond the hedgerows skirting the main road. So began a love affair that has lingered to this day. It wasn't until I grew up that I finally got close to the house, which can be accessed only by the Red Lane, opposite the Red House Hotel. By then, I had discovered that the house was called Morristown Latin. I also discovered that the avenue of trees, which appeared to lead right up to the house, stopped in a field adjacent to the Red Lane. It was a marvellous piece of landscaping created by some long-forgotten member of the Latin family. Newbridge, being a relatively new town, a mere 200 years in the making, has not a great heritage of magnificent houses or historical ruins. So, to me as a child who read fairy tales voraciously, finding Morristown Latin on the outskirts of our town was akin to unearthing treasure. Over the years, serendipitous conversations would bring new information. Like the time I attended a party in the old mill at Victoria Bridge, not half a mile from the house. Its then owner, Owen O'Toole, told me that Jack Latin, whose name is scored into a support beam at the mill, is mentioned in James Joyce's Ulysses. Further research unearthed details of Jack Latin's untimely death at the age of 21. Family legend tells how he fiddled and danced the 12 miles of road between Morristown Latin and Castle Brown, now Clongowswood College, only to drop dead of exhaustion soon after he arrived. Another recounting of the legend has Jack Latin, as a result of a wager, dancing home all the way from Dublin, about 25 miles, changing his dance step every furlong. It seems he won the wager but lost his life. Immortalised in Ulysses, the phrase, "I'll make you dance, Jack Latin," was uttered by the furious Mrs. Mervyn Tallboys to a quivering Leopold Bloom in punishment for the obscene postcards he'd sent her. Morristown Latin featured in episodes of The Irish RM, the TV series starring Peter Bowles and Brian Murray, which aired in the 1980s. It was filmed from the outside as the home of Flurry Knox's mother. Historian Turtle Bunbury writes that Morristown Latin was built in 1692 by the Latin family, who were prominent merchants in Kildare during the 16th and 17th centuries. The house passed by marriage to the Mansfield family in 1836. The Mansfields have been in Ireland since the 12th century. They were penalised for their Catholicism in the 17th century. But fortune returned when two of them married the heiresses of Yeomanstown House and Morristown Latin. As a child, I recall the fur-coated Madam Mansfield, then an old lady, who called door to door each November to sell poppies for Remembrance Day. In my teens, I had a huge crush on the handsome Timmy Mansfield, an exotic young man who came from Australia with his parents to live in another family residence, Barrettstown House. It was he who told me about the gelding Liz Navarre, who served with his owner, Captain Eustace Mansfield, on the Western Front in World War I. Horse and master survived the war, and Liz Navarre is buried near the greenhouse on the grounds of Morristown Latin. When my own children were small, I often detoured down the Red Lane and, stopping at the gates, I'd tell them how, when we won the lottery, we were going to buy this house and host murder mystery weekends for paying guests. Sadly, that has not transpired, but in my suburban semi-D, I can still dream, can't I? Today, Morristown Latin is the family home of the Cassidy Walshes. They're also custodians of the Gore Booth legacy, Lissadell. So I know that in their safe hands, Morristown Latin will be preserved and protected. And for me, that's enough.
When I started teaching Ulysses as a doctoral student in my mid-20s, I was just a few years older than the 22-year-old Stephen Dedalus. Now, at 44, I'm 6 years older than its other main protagonist, Leopold Bloom. The age gap between the two men is central to the basic plot of Ulysses, a very simple story. A talented but clueless young man, Stephen Dedalus, is abandoned by his friends during an unhappy drinking binge. He runs into an acquaintance of his father's, Leopold Bloom, who takes Stephen back to his house to sober him up and have a chat. We know nothing about what happens to the characters after this encounter. The novel opens and closes with that one day, 16th of June 1904. As the Irish expression goes, Ní lá na chlá dár saol, all it is a day in the life. Joyce's novel hints that Stephen is somehow in need of a father, while Bloom is looking for a son. What does this mean? In a literal sense, Bloom is already a father. Although his son died in infancy, he has a daughter. And while Stephen is traumatised by the recent death of his mother, his father, Simon Dedalus, is very much alive. Simon Dedalus is in a way one of the villains of Ulysses, a vainglorious, self-centred lout who spends his time carousing with his cronies while his hungry children boil shoe leather for soup. But the novel is also saturated with them. His singing voice bewitches the whole company in the Ormond Hotel, and his quick wit and sparkling vernacular energy give the novel much of its humour and tone. He may be, as Stephen says about him in A Portrait, a bankrupt, a praiser of his own past, but the attention devoted to Simon Dedalus in Ulysses, to his songs, turns of phrase, to his ability to tell a story, betrays a deep, loving fascination on Joyce's part with the world of his own Cork father. No matter what kind of father you have, parents contain the mystery of our own origins, and their world before they had children is often a source of special, magical curiosity for their offspring. You see this especially in people whose parents are dead or far away. As my father would have said, people say, trying to find a way to make the lost or absent parent speak again. When I think of my own father, mercifully as different from Simon Dedalus as it is possible to imagine, his boyhood, playing cowboys and Indians on the banks of the Suck in the 1950s, seems to me a sort of enchanted landscape. Now that my own childhood, on a housing estate in the 1980s, begins to take on increasingly sepia tones, I find myself ever more aware that since I do not have children, no one will ever have that kind of fascination for my early life. My memories of Tip the Can and BMXs and cola bottles will pass away with me, unscrutinised and uncelebrated by any son or daughter. I feel no tragic regret at not having children, but I do notice that my daily emotional life is increasingly haunted by the ghost of the father I will never be. In teaching, for example, many versions of the overwhelming feelings parents must have for their children project themselves onto my students. I find myself terrified by their vulnerability in what seems like a harsh world. I feel envious of their youthful energy and afraid that it will find me aged and irrelevant. I am overcome with curiosity and concern as to what they will become in the world after my classroom. In my semester-long course in Ulysses, by the time Stephen and Bloom finally meet and talk over cocoa in Eccles Street, the students, someone else's daughters and sons, are getting ready for the summer. Most of them, when they walk out of the classroom, will also walk out of my life, forever. And, as I get older, I feel ashamed of the intensity of the melancholy this departure incites in me. It feels very childless, a pale, pitiful substitute for the great adventure of parental love. A kind of mourning by a mind, or even body, that is surprised not to find itself a parent at 44. After their conversation in the kitchen, Stephen refuses Bloom's offer of a bed for the night, and he steps out into the dawn, never to be seen again, at least not by us, the readers. That one day is all we will ever know of the characters. The meaning of the encounter between the younger man and the older man resides entirely in the passing impulses and instincts that, however briefly, bound them to one another on the 16th of June. What I take from the meeting between Bloom and Stephen is that parenthood is not only a long-term investment that will ultimately offer emotional payoff. It can also express itself as a short-lived, ephemeral flow of feeling from the older to the younger, a passing desire to protect or connect, to open the door and offer respite to those who have lost their networks of comfort and support, those who need temporary material or psychological refuge, to those who are orphaned in all the many ways that this is possible in an unequal, war-torn world. These feelings for other people's children, as it were, may not be merely substitutes for the real thing, but something rich and even valuable, even if they only flare up briefly, even if Ní lá na chlá dár saol.
sheltered me from harm, kept me warm, kept me warm. You gave my life to me, set me free, set me free. The finest years I ever knew were all the years I had with you.
The tragic story of Lucia Joyce, talented, troubled daughter of James Joyce and Nora Barnacle, is well known, at a surface level, at least. Her first stint in an asylum was in February 1932, the month of her father's 50th birthday. On hearing that Samuel Beckett, who had spurned her cruelly in love, had been invited to the party, Lucia threw a chair at her mother. It was her brother, Giorgio, newly married with a baby on the way, who committed her to the asylum. Lucia did get home on time to knit a lovely little welcome to the world jumper for her baby nephew, Stephen, who was born a week later. But the grim precedent for her life had been set, and she spent the majority of the five decades that followed in institutions. As a dance historian, I've been intrigued by Lucia Joyce's overlooked dancing prowess for many years. I wanted to ensure that her career as a modern dancer at the heart of 1920s Paris was reclaimed into 20th century Irish cultural history, or her story. And I set out to do this last year in a radio documentary with actress Ivana Lynch voicing what little survives of Lucia's own words. And I wrote to that baby nephew of hers, Stephen Joyce, in Ile de Ré, France, to invite a contribution from this last living descendant of Joyce and notoriously obstinate custodian of the Joyce estate. 9 days after I posted the letter, the phone rang.
a 0033 prefix. Could this be? I took a deep breath and picked up to hear a raspy male voice. I got a letter! I got a letter! Is that Stephen Joyce? I said, delighted. Thank you so much for getting back to me. So you got my letter about my documentary. I'm 87 years old. I'm 87 years old. Ireland has disgraced herself again. He sounded furious. Carefully, I ventured. How has Ireland disgraced herself? Have you read that terrible book, The Joyce Girl? Oh, yes, I have, I said. The Joyce Girl is a novel which controversially imagines an incestuous relationship between James Joyce and Lucia. I couldn't agree with you more, I told Stephen Joyce. I don't believe in writing spurious fiction about real people. Awful. But how has Ireland disgraced itself? By giving the book an award. This was news to me. Really? How terrible. I'm sorry to hear that. You should get a group of people together and write a letter to the Irish Times, the raspy voice continued. Actually, I already did write an article in the Irish Times about Lucia, and I mentioned spurious works of fiction, I said, hoping this would placate him. I can send you a copy. I was born in 1932, and by then, Lucia was already ill. She was in institutions for 45 years. Leave Lucia to me. I'll take care of her. A slight pause, then some backpedaling. No, not in that way, but I'll take care of her. I thought it was time to state my case. Well, Stephen, I'm a dance historian, and my interest in your aunt is as a dancer, an artist in her own right. I explained I'd found some interesting correspondence shedding light on Lucia's significance as a dancer. I'm only interested in the facts. That's why I wrote, wondering if you might like to contribute to this documentary I'm making. Another silence. How old are you? It was my turn to pause. I'm in my 40s, I offered, studiously vague. Well, I'm 87, and you shouldn't be calling me by my first name. Oh, I'm very sorry, Mr. Joyce. I just wanted to let you know about my project. Well, thank you for letting me know. Keep me posted about your documentary. And please write a letter to the Irish Times about that terrible book, The Joyce Girl. It's based on another book by Carol Schloss. Have you read that? Actually, yes, I have, I said, and decided now was not the time to mention that I had just interviewed Schloss down the line from Dublin to Philadelphia as the backbone for this same radio documentary I was telling him about. Instead, our conversation found its way to Molly, the new Museum of Literature at Newman House. And, getting chatty now, Mr. Joyce divulged that the director was coming to visit him in the next week. Oh, I just interviewed him the day before yesterday about the composer George Antheil in relation to Lucia for the documentary. Yes, I knew George Antheil. Oh, really? Well, George Antheil wrote the score for Yeats's Fighting the Waves. I started to set out my theory. But Mr. Joyce was now apparently conversing in French with somebody else. My helper, she's leaving now, so I have to go. Oh, well, thank you so much for the phone call, Mr. Joyce, and I hope you have a lovely day. It's grey, he growled at my impudent suggestion. Okay, well, all the best, Mr. Joyce, and I'll keep you posted. We had spoken for 12 minutes in total. 12 historic minutes. Unsurprisingly, Mr. Joyce did not take part in my radio documentary, but never let it be said I didn't ask. And there will be no more phone calls. Stephen Joyce died in January of this year, just a month short of his 88th birthday. Not long after my conversation with him, awaiting Ivana on the day of our recording, I randomly opened that Schloss biography upon a 1935 letter from Lucia to her father's patron, Harriet Weaver. These lines jumped out at me. "Dear Miss Weaver, one of the doctors I was in contact with said I really have a great wish to live and an immense love of life. He was right, and perhaps you know somebody who will explain this to you quite carefully. With kindest regards, Lucia Joyce."
On this morning's programme, we heard James Joyce Singer by Fran O'Rourke, Nation Speaking Peace Unto Nation by Conall Hamill, Morristown Latin by Breda Reed, Father for a Day by Barry McRae, and Phone Call with Mr. Joyce by Deirdre Mulrooney. This morning's music began with Love's Old Sweet Song, sung by John McCormack. Then Navajo Love Song by Ed Lee Nattei. I Dreamt I Dwelt in Marble Halls, sung by Veronica Dunn. And finally, Everything I Own by Bread. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.